Okay, so good afternoon. I want to make some comments in relation to the earthquake support subsidy and job loss cover programs, both which are operating in Christchurch. When I've had an opportunity to go through those, we're going to take questions, either myself or the Minister, and then we'll just resume the normal press conference and talk about the other issues that you might be interested in. But today I'm announcing the government's next steps to support Christchurch businesses and employees. The initial earthquake support subsidy and job loss cover were both due to end on April 4. Cabinet has decided to extend two pieces of assistance out to April the 18th, giving employers and employees more time to consider their options going forward. Following this two-week extension, there will be a second round of earthquake support subsidy for a further 6 weeks. The criteria for accessing this support will be more tightly targeted. Only those employers currently receiving the earthquake support subsidy will be able to apply. They must also demonstrate that they need only short-term support before being able to pay wages themselves. Employers who need to apply will need to apply by April 5th for the extension of the current earthquake support subsidy, and will also need to reapply for the second round of the initiative. Application forms are available on the MSD website. Businesses wanting to take up the second round of the earthquake support subsidy will also need to be within the Christchurch City Council boundaries and need to show they are unable to operate due to physical barriers caused by the earthquake. There will be an exceptions process so that businesses which do not meet the Chitin criteria but which can demonstrate a strong case for limited additional support can be catered for on a case-by-case basis. The new earthquake support subsidy will, for the first fortnight, stand at the current rate of $500 gross per week for full-time employees and $300 a week for part-time employees. This will reduce to $375 and $225 for the second fortnight and $250 and $150 respectively for the third fortnight. A total of $153 million has been spent on the earthquake support package to date, and the package extension announced today is expected to cost a further $91 million. The job loss cover will end on April the 18th. This gives people who lost full-time employment immediately after the earthquake $400 net per week, and people who lost part-time employment $240 net per week. Around about 6,700 people have taken up this level of support. Following on from the earthquake job loss cover initiative, a new individual support payment will be introduced, which will essentially be a top-up in addition to the unemployment benefit. The individual support payment recognises people who have lost their main source of income and provides alternative support as they move to look for alternative work. The top-up rate will be $50 per week for a single person, $80 per week for a couple without children or a sole parent, plus $10 a week for each child, up to a maximum of $110 per week. The individual support payment will be in place for 6 weeks after April the 18th. People currently receiving job loss cover will not need to reapply for the extension, but will need to apply for the new individual support payment. The extended financial support for businesses and individuals is part of the government's wider economic recovery package for Christchurch and the Canterbury region, which Gerry Brownlee and David Carter announced last week. Today's announcement is the latest step in a series of actions we have taken following the February 22nd earthquake. Later today, Finance Minister Bill English and Revenue Minister Peter Dunn will also be outlining some tax measures to make it easier for the Christchurch businesses to comply with their obligations given the disruption the earthquake has caused them. So that's all for those two programs. Maybe we'll just take some questions and then we'll bring them up to the screen.
So, essentially, are you winding it back because we simply can't afford to go on funding it at that level, especially given it's going to cost $170 million for 6 weeks?
Yeah, so it's been a generous program, and that's because we erred on the side of generosity, as I said, when we announced the program. And it was essentially universally applied to people in the area of Christchurch that had significant disruption as a result of the earthquake. I think it makes sense to give people a little more time, but essentially the message is that we're wanting businesses and employees to use this time now to assess their likely future. for companies. We are giving them more time, but eventually they're going to have to work with those business mentors and demonstrate that they have actually got a plan for operation, whether it might be in temporary premises or with reduced staff. And when it comes to employees, essentially we are transitioning them to the unemployment benefit, but paying additional payments options through it. So it's a recognition that this is a period of time which is an interim step as people regroup after the earthquake, but also acknowledging that they do need to make plans for their future now.
So something like 65,000 people have used it. Is that effectively going to mean that the dole queues are going to increase by 50,000 or 60,000 at the end?
No, and
in a couple of different respects. So one is around sole traders. So there's about 11,000 sole traders or contractors that have been getting the employee support. They won't be eligible anymore. And you'd sort of think after, with the extension of the 2 weeks, that after 8 weeks, they would be able to make a judgment as to whether or not they can continue on or not. The other is we've been ringing those on the job loss cover, so about 6,700 on that at the moment. We've made contact with 2,500 of them, and about a third have actually gone into work. So it does tell us that there is some work there. Last week, Work and Income did a major push on jobs that were available and came up with 138 jobs just in that week, mainly in hospitality and retail, obviously in that sort of outer suburbs area, which are proving to be a bit busier. So there is some work there. We acknowledge that that we certainly are seeing people go on the benefit more than we have in this time last year, obviously, but we don't expect it to be that higher numbers.
You say this is giving those businesses time to, yeah, to sort out the future, because we've had all of these concerns expressed by businesses in the CBD that they can't get, yeah, get the stuff they need to actually carry on business. Yeah. I mean, will there be a concerted effort to help them actually get in and get them the material they need to actually carry on their business?
Yes, so work is happening in terms of the cordoned area, and that has reduced by about 80% actually, is the advice I've had. Now, we would be the first to acknowledge these frustrations on the part of some of those businesses that can't get in. But the assessment, of course, is one of safety. And so unless we can be sure that a business owner can enter their premises on a basis which is not likely to endanger their life, then we're being irresponsible letting them in. But I know that the National Patrol is working as aggressively as they can to allow entry in. And there's been a lot of businesses that have actually had access, and in fact, I have the number, it's 5,000 or... there's quite a big number that's actually been in, and we know that they're actually working, I might add, with what is the old Chamber of Commerce, the Canberra Business Recovery Group. To date, over 3,500 businesses have registered for access, and 553 have had access to premises. But yes, we acknowledge the other sort of teething frustrations that are going on. So when you think about this is a package that will, in final conclusion, run for 14 weeks or in about months, that's buying them some time, but won't necessarily resolve all your issues.
What will you do then for a business, for instance, that's can't get into the CBD and just hasn't been able to get all of the material they need to keep on running their business? I mean, will there be any support beyond to help them back to their feet, or will they just...
Yes, there's a number of things. I mean, we announced the business package last week. So one part of that is the business mentors that are going to go and work alongside those businesses. So I think the first thing is there's only so long the government can provide cash. I mean, there are actually many other elements that businesses are actually wanting and will be most useful for them. For instance, the alternative premises, the access to financing, as we saw from ASB's announcement in the weekend. Some sense of matching up skills, for instance. So I think that there'll be a different response from different businesses. Some will say, look, this is an interruption in my business, and I'm not going to be in CBD for quite a long period of time, so I can set up somewhere else. Others will simply say, the earthquake's had such a devastating effect that that's terminating the lifeline of that business. Others will be, you know, able to take a more positive sort of view on things. And I think everyone acknowledges we can't go on forever with the packages we've got. But we also can want to leave people high and dry, and I think we've got the balance about right here.
Is 2 months an appropriate balance, though, given the devastation in the CBD? Is 2 months enough time for business owners actually to plan their future and know whether they can be viable?
Well, it's 3 and a bit months if you think about 14 weeks, isn't it, in terms of the total package, 8 and then 36. Again, it depends on the business. It depends whether they get access, and depends on what they think they're, what type of business they are. For some businesses which are in retail and CBD, then obviously they can see, like we can see, it's a significant rebuild phase. and it won't be possible to establish business straight away. Others are starting to move out into the suburbs and operating the businesses that
way. Can you just give me, with respect to the answer previously, can either of you give me an estimate on how many people this will add to the Dole Group? We've been given numbers about how many people it's going to add to.
No, we don't have firm numbers on that. It's just too soon to do that. But certainly once particularly the business coordinators are working with those businesses as well and looking at how we can progress that, I think, at the moment we are seeing a small increase in Christchurch. You've got to say 6,700 on the job loss cover, about a third of them finding jobs. So you can sort of do some numbers around that. But they are estimates and guesstimates, really, at the best of it. So we won't know until we get a bit further down the track with it.
Just to clarify, you were saying before that retailers could extend out of the CBD to other areas, particularly with retailers. What advice have you got about the viability of that, given that Christchurch has a series of urban peripheral malls, which are generally quite full?
Yeah, so it depends. Space is filling up in some of those areas where there's been empty space. Some of the advice we've had is that actually trade is very busy for people outside of the CBD because people are moving their business activities away from the CBD, and in fact retailers are experiencing quite a boom in some of their activity simply because people are now located in different parts of the city. So again, it very much depends.
Is this the end of it when it comes to these packages? That's pretty much it then.
Well, I think we'd be 3 months on. We'll be in a position, I think, for those businesses and employees to assess, have a better ability to assess their future and what that might mean. I'm not going to rule out having other initiatives, and certainly on the business recovery front, we do have other initiatives. But the reason that we're phasing out the employer wage subsidy from being 100% funded at like $500 a week to three-quarters and then half and 25% funding is a recognition that is phasing out over time, and they're going to have to adjust to the new rule of order they find themselves in.
And you're looking at having spent, $250 million on this?
So it's not insignificant. I mean, it's a lot of money, and there are people right around the country who face different circumstances, but in some sense are similar circumstances. They've lost their job or their business may caused interruption for some reason. It's just the scale in Christchurch. So, so I think we've got balance about right, but it's not without a price tag, and we're trying to give Christchurch all the support that we can.
These subsidies are all going to expire just in the middle of winter, really, aren't they? It's going to be a pretty tough winter for Christchurch, I would imagine.
It's not quite as blunt as that sounds, though, because you've got to remember people who are on job loss cover, they're transitioning effectively on to the unemployment benefit and at a higher rate of supplementary payments. Those who are using the employer subsidy scheme, they will have had 3 months of trying to get that relationship together. We couldn't expect the business in day one to have a realistic assessment of its business employee needs or whether it can actually operate and where and what its cost base is likely to look like. But with 3 months on, they will. And some of those businesses that the package announced in the weekend by ASB was $200 million worth of funding for the SME sector at 0% interest for 1 year. That may change the dynamics of whether a small business can actually operate.
Those transitioning to the UEB and the extra payment for them, the independent payment, how long would that continue for?
That's continuing for 6 weeks after the 18th of April. So we are extending the job loss cover until the 18th of April, and then there'll be 6 weeks after that that the extended support payment will be there.
Payment stops after those 6 weeks?
Yes, it does.
Is there any help planned or available for families who decide they have to leave Christchurch and find work elsewhere because there's none, their job's gone?
There is currently help, so there's certainly hardship grants to help those people move. There is certainly special payments. There's also the special needs grants that are there, so there is help available for people that want to relocate under certain circumstances.
But that's not over and above what's already there?
No, but this is exactly what it's kind of for, if you like, so it has been used. And there's also the civil defence payments, which we spent about $15 million on them for about 84,000 payments to date, so they've certainly been used for a range of things as well.
Do you know how much raised from the international
fundraising? So far? Look, in total, I don't mean, our fund's sitting at about $35 million. But there's a whole range of things that we're working on, and while something like the ASB announcement isn't specifically part of the fund, it's not being channeled through the fund, $1 million might be that they're giving, but the rest of it isn't. It is part of, you know, our efforts, I think you can at least say that, and us going out and talking to businesses. So over the course of the next 4 to 6 weeks, we're looking to firm that number up. We've got quite a number of people who've made pledges to us of a significant nature, but we haven't firmed up exactly where that money's going to be used for yet.
Have you spoken to any other banks about whether they would provide mortgage support like ASB has?
I haven't directly, but I'm aware that banks are looking at their position and what they might want to offer, and look, we're encouraging them to actively consider what they might want to do for Christchurch.
Will you be announcing the government agency overseeing the rebuild of Christchurch tomorrow?
Yeah, I want to move on to that to finish with this so I can have to move on. Okay, so on that happy note, tomorrow I'll travel to Christchurch with the Minister for Canterbury Earthquake Recovery, Gerry Brownlee, to announce the establishment of a new authority to provide leadership and coordination of the ongoing recovery. As I've said before, it's clear that the scale of the task in Canterbury is too big to be handled by existing institutions. The new authority will pull together the resources of central government and coordinate them so that we have an effective, timely recovery. People want action in Christchurch, and I'm confident we have come up with a structure that will give them that while working in collaboration with the local councils and communities. Just cover off a couple of other quick things and then take questions you might have. You'll be aware of reports of serious bullying incidents in schools around the country. I take the issue of bullying extremely seriously, and I'm determined we'll do everything we can as a government to ensure our schools are safe for students. I've asked the Education Minister to write to all boards of trustees and to reaffirm to them their responsibilities to provide safe environments for children in their care. It's my expectation that the boards will meet with their school principals to ensure that they have in place a solid and workable plan for combating bullying. It's also my expectation that ERO audits will reflect the adequacy of those anti-bullying plans. The Minister of Education, Anne Tolley, will be convening a meeting of relevant parties to assess whether we have in place the best practices in this area. Just finally, in terms of my activity, Wednesday I'm in Ashburton and Timaru, and on Thursday I'm back in Christchurch to open new facilities at Burnside High School and Summerfield School. On Friday we've been doing a number of events with the Indian community. On Saturday I'm excited for things I'm particularly for the National Sharing Champs.
Do you deny the reports that Martin Dunn was the man you wanted for the day to see anything that actually would have matured for him?
Well, look, I think it's important to understand the process. The State Services Commissioner considered a number of names for interim chief executive. I'd hasten to add that's a person that is going to be appointed for a relatively short period of time. The process of finding a full-time chief executive for the new government department will be announced tomorrow is well along the way. Martin Dunn was one of those names, but in the end, the State Services Commissioner settled on another name.
So we don't have a name tomorrow?
You will have a name tomorrow, but it's not Martin Dunn.
So it was the State Services Commission.
Sorry.
It was the State Services Commission that selected someone else.
It
wasn't
because Martin Gordon's out. That's right. I mean, the State Services Commissioner makes that appointment. Now, he does that on a variety of different reasons. I'm sure he has discussions with the candidates, and from time to time they have discussions with the minister. But in the end, the decision to appoint the chief executive follows normal state service practice, and that's a matter for the State Services Commissioner.
So he was never offered the job then?
Well, effectively no, because the appointment is made, there's been one appointment made, and that's the appointment that's been made tomorrow.
When you say effectively no, what do
you mean? Well, there were discussions with Martin Dunlop, we're not denying that, and Martin's been doing some work for us in this area. He's also very keen to go to Australia to be our High Commissioner. So there were discussions, but in the end, the decision was made by the State Services Commission.
So those discussions suggest that Mr. Dunlop would be...
I can't comment on that because I haven't had direct discussions with the State Services Commission.
But was he acceptable to the government, so the minister or him yourself?
Well, he would be acceptable as a name. Without doubt, we have great confidence in Martin Dunn. He's done a tremendous job at customs and will make a fabulous High Commissioner in Australia, and we're very happy for him to do the interim work. In the end, if that had been the name put forward, he would have been an acceptable name, but there were a number of names, and in the final analysis, the State Services Commissioner has settled on one name, and this name will be announced tomorrow.
So why was his name mentioned at a briefing in Christchurch on Friday as the man who had the job?
Yeah, we had mixed reports about whether that's true or not. I don't know, I wasn't there, so I can't confirm it one way or the other.
Was there some difference of agreement over the structure of the
I don't know the final reasons why the State Services Commissioner actually agreed on the name that's being announced tomorrow. I haven't spoken to Ian Rennie about that, and I'm not privy to those conversations. I know just in the end, the name that has been given to me is not the name Martin Dunn.
Who's the new name?
I'll tell you tomorrow. Come down to Christchurch and we'll see you there.
Did you hear anything directly that you may have had an issue with Jerry Brown yet?
About Jerry Brownlee or
Martin Dunn?
No, I mean, we're happy with the work that he's doing for us. He was only ever on the frame, potentially someone to play the interim chief executive's role in the State Services Commissioner, who has responsibility for the appointment, settled on another name.
Are you aware of any significant dispute between Dunn
and Brown? Not overly, no. I mean, look, I think there have been discussions, but I'm not aware of any major dispute. And then another State Services Commissioner decided it would be another name. I haven't spent a lot of time on it.
The State Services Commission only sent through a name that was finally agreed and settled, didn't they? So the name that was sent through Martin Dunn wouldn't suggest that Martin Dunn hadn't been spoken to or approached.
Well, it's standard practice to have discussions with ministers, but in the end, the decision about an appointment to a government department is a decision made by the State Services Commissioner. We've accepted his recommendation.
So did the State Services Commission have any discussions about Martin Dunn, or did they even consider an application for him?
I don't know if they can take it up with him. We're not arguing that they were having discussions with him. I don't know how far advanced that got.
It's got around fairly strongly, and some media organisations have had confirmation that Jerry Brownlee was telling people that Martin Dunn would be the appointment. So something's gone wrong, hasn't it?
Well, you have to take that up with either Jerry Brownlee or Martin Dunn or Ian Rennie. But all I can tell you is the State Services Commissioner who makes the appointment has settled on another name.
Did you ever believe that Martin Dunn is the one that Jerry Brownlee indicated that to you?
I only believe things when I said it in writing, and that was the name I said in writing.
Did you get it orally, though?
I was advised there were a number of names in the frame.
There was another name that came out last week, I think,
reported
by Trans
Tasman. Yeah.
That's not the first name?
Oh, we have to wait till tomorrow.
Because you moved that out,
I did at the time, yeah.
Would you be concerned, you've just said that you really rate Martin Dunn, would you be concerned that if his reason for not wanting the role was that he couldn't work with one of your ministers?
Well, look, I don't think you should jump to conclusions. Martin's done some good work for us. As an interim position, I don't know in the final analysis why Ian Rennie settled on the name that he did. You have to ask Ian that. But it's standard practice for there to be a number of names considered, and in the end, he settled on another name.
I don't think we're jumping to any conclusions. We're actually trying to find out what conclusion we should jump to. I mean, we're told this person's going to be appointed, everyone's talking about it, officials are saying it's going to be him, yep. And then suddenly another name's put forward without explanation from the SSC.
Sure. Well, this is the conclusion to jump to. Ian Rennie has sole responsibility for determining who the new head of the agency is. He has determined that it's not going to be Martin Dunn, it will be another name.
So
well, that's always the case until ultimately the Commissioner makes a decision. And there wasn't a formalised offer made. It's a moment.
Is there a job description for this position? And if so, who is the chief executive of that agency going to be responsible to or accountable to?
Yeah, so there is a job description, as you obviously expect. The Commissioner's been working through the process of trying to narrow down the sorts of people that could be appropriate for the full-time role, and the person's responsible to the minister, which is Jerry Brown.
Is that perhaps the problem, that there's something unusual about the way that this position is established, that there's not a great
I should correct this. The person's not responsible. It's responsible to the State Services Commission, like any other chief executive, but they work with the minister. In this case, the minister will be Jerry Brown. Yeah.
No, there are some problems between...
I'm happy to go.
There seem to be some problems between EQC and the private insurance companies. Will this commission perhaps, this new organisation perhaps, be able to have power to make them see eye to eye at all? Or will that be left up to them themselves?
We'll outline tomorrow the powers of the new entity, so we do have to leave that question tomorrow. I've seen the media reports that you're referring to. I haven't had any formal advice on that. I don't know if there's any validity in those those arguments being put forward. All I can tell you is tomorrow we're going to announce a new agency, and the purpose of that agency is to give support to the Minister so that we can rebuild Christchurch as quickly and effectively as possible. And I think that's a big task we will really pass that.
Cool. And just with budget cuts, with the upcoming budget, you said this morning that the justice portfolio would also have...
Yes, there's three areas that ultimately get more health, education and justice.
OK, well, that started off as two. Like, when do you decide you make decisions on...
Yeah, well, it's always been three, but the primary amount of reallocated money will go to health and education, but one or two of the policy announcements we made will require new cash. It's just the fact that they filter through.
How are the efforts going to find that $100 million?
How are we going to?
How are the efforts going so
far? Oh, it's going well, actually. There's another meeting tonight with budget ministers. We're working our way through it. It's not easy. I mean, we're fine having to find a significant amount of cash to reallocate. But I think the country understands and recognises the situation government faces, and that is that somehow the earthquake's got to be paid for. And as I've been saying, the options are simply a direct impost on people of New Zealand, or the government tightens its belt. And I think the latter is a better and fairer response.
Phil Goff doesn't think he's made any mistakes over the Darren Hughes affair. Do you agree with that?
Look, I think ultimately that's a matter for Labour caucus and for New Zealanders to reflect upon.
You wouldn't have handled it that way then?
Well, I just don't want to go and critique. I don't know all of the details. I haven't supposed to know all those. All I can say, in public office, you are on display to the public. They have a chance to assess how you handle matters and what that might mean for future issues that you need to deal with, and I'll let them go and make those assessments.
Can I ask you about the bullying stuff a little bit more detail around that? Have you had any advice? Can you just, I suppose, describe the problem that you're trying to solve with this
Well, look, I think the internet is an interesting dynamic which has changed the nature of bullying, as has the advent of mobile phones at school. So I think there's a range of different devices being used by young people. And so bullying that may have taken place when I was at school, I think, is quite different to what happens in the modern day schooling environment. So text bullying and all of those things are occurring. I think, all New Zealand parents demand that their school is a safe environment, and principals have a responsibility to ensure that environment is safe. And my message is a very clear message. I have very high expectations that youngsters will be able to go to school and enjoy being at school in a safe environment. And if they're subject to bullying, I expect that to be dealt with. And so the boards of trustees, by law, have a responsibility to deliver a safe environment. The purpose of the minister writing to them is to make sure that the government's expectations are spelled out very clearly, and I expect those boards of trustees to sit down with their principal, the principal in turn to sit down with all of their staff, and in fact with the pupils, and for us to have a nationwide conversation about how we are going to make sure that there is less bullying taking place in our schools.
Are you concerned that they are not fulfilling their responsibilities in that respect?
Well, it's hard for me to assess whether it's getting worse. I think the nature of the way it's displayed is definitely changing because of modern technology. And it's sometimes it's a little bit dangerous to say these things are getting worse, but the sorts of scenes we've seen in, displayed on the internet recently worry me a great deal. And I worry about bullying. I worry about youngsters going to school and being intimidated by others. And it's thuggish type behaviour that needs to stop. And we want to send a strong message about that.
Are you talking about the video of the kid?
That's one.
Throwing the guy on the ground.
But there are others.
Because that's in Australia.
No, not the one in Australia, the one in New Zealand.
So what would you expect to see in the next,
I hope that we'll see schools actually reviewing their policy in this area, that they will go away and have a discussion with their staff about how they might be able to ensure that safe environment is delivered, that they'll be talking to their students about that. I mean, this is not something that's just... engages the staff. I mean, I think students have a responsibility as well, and I think parents actually have a responsibility, but I think all of us can reflect back at school. I mean, bullying isn't exactly new. As I say, the way it's potentially occurring is changing, but we need to understand what happens when bullying gets out of control, and that is, taken to the extreme, some youngsters take their own lives, and I'm not going to sit back and let that happen without at least trying to improve the environment.
What do you make of the complaint that some parents have made that, while we have rules and policies against bullying, schools actually haven't been implementing them or following them properly?
That's my point. I can't answer that question, but I can answer. I know what their legal responsibility is, and by writing to them, I'm outlining very clearly the government's expectation in this area that there will be an improvement, and that they will go away and be actively not only working on that, but ERO will be making sure, as of course, as they go about their audits, that those schools do have in place an adequate anti-bullying plan, and they're implementing that plan.
ERO already has quite a big emphasis on that in their reports, doesn't it?
It does, but, I mean, let's see whether we can do better.
But what about provision of support from the government? Because I think there was anti-bullying and the programs around violence in schools, which was concerned to both teachers and boards, which I think 2 or 3 years ago
we
the government pulled back on.
Yeah, we were critical of parts because we didn't think they were effective. That's one of the reasons why I've asked the Minister to convene a meeting with the interested parties and relevant parties to see whether we are adopting the best practice in this area.
Wouldn't there be any formal deliverables at this moment, at this point, is it just a conversation, a refreshing of those responsibilities in the minds of schools and trustees?
Well, as I say, it's a starting point, but I mean, it's an example that we take this matter seriously, that we are directly communicating with those boards of trustees.
Is this something that you expect to feed into the budget anyway?
Look, at this point, I can't see why we would need to do something in that area. I mean, we've made it clear education would be getting more money. I mean, if this is something where ultimately the ministry and the schools come back and say they need more money, that's something the minister can go and look at. But I don't think it's an issue actually of cash. I think it's an issue of attitude and whether we are prepared to stand up and actually take a stance against bullying. And I think we should as a country. I think it's wrong that kids are getting bullied. And I accept that you can't close down every aspect of bullying, but I think the message has to be very strong from the top that we expect a safe environment.
Just to clarify on those three areas of the budget that you're saying are going to have increased spending, are you talking about an increase in real spending on top of, as well as nominal?
Well, I'm talking about they will get more money, new money.
So nominally?
Nominally new money, but it comes... for the most part, from what I can see, reallocated spending comes from other departments.
So if you're looking at real spending for those 3 years, that could fall by
Depends. I mean, looking at the numbers, we've largely tried to, in real terms, keep pace with health and education spending, and in broad terms, if we do what we're planning, it'll be fairly consistent with that. Okay, thanks.